Who knows who John Glenn is?
Earth.
Got time, John Glenn. John Glenn, first American to orbit the Earth in space.
Gil,
was a senator for the state of Ohio. Oldest man to go back up into space because he's a PC god. Before all of that, he was a fucking Marine.
An air winger, though, a pilot.
Right, Captain Smith?
Right. Have that camera. Get the fuck away from me. John Glenn, 1974, ran for Senate against a politician named Howard Metzenbaum. Howard Metzenbaum was a sorry motherfucker. John Glenn, at this point, was a Marine, first American to orbit the Earth in space. Howard Metzenbaum asked him, how can you run for Senate when you never held a job? What the fuck would you do if somebody said that shit to you? Now, I'm going to change a little bit of this. I can. It's my world. John Glenn said, is that right? I served 23 years in the United States Marine Corps. I fought for two wars. I flew 149 missions. My plane was hit by an aircraft fire on 12 different occasions. I was in the space program. It wasn't my job. It was my life that was on the line. And this wasn't a 9-to-5 job where I could take time off to take the daily cash receipts to the bank. I asked you to come with me as I went the other day to a veteran's hospital. And you stand there. You look at those men with their mangled bodies. You look them in the eye and tell them that they never held a job. You come with me and visit any Gold Star mother. You look her in the eye and tell her her son never held a job. You come with me to the space program and visit the widows and the orphans of Ed White, Gus Grissom, and Roger Chaykin. And you look those kids in the eye and tell them that their dads never held a job. You come with me on this Memorial Day weekend coming up to Arlington National Cemetery, where I got more friends than I'd like to remember. And you stand there, you watch those waving flags, you think about this nation, and you tell me that those people never held a job. Fuck! I'll tell you, Howard Metzenbaum, you should be on your knees every day of your life, thanking God that there are some men who have held a job. And they required a dedication to purpose, a love of country, and a dedication to duty that was more important than life itself. Their self-sacrifice is what made this country fucking possible.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I'm on with my co-host, Chantel Taylor, former British Army combat medic. Chantel, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going, John?
It's good. I had a good conversation with Pete Perry. Pete is a former Marine Raider. And Pete was there for the inception of MARSOC, the Marine Special Operations Command. And he went through that entire transition from the Force Reconnaissance Battalions into MARSOC, what is now known as the Marine Raiders. So it's interesting, you know, the MARSOC community has only been around for about 11 years now. And they are the Marine component to SOCOM, the Special Operations Command. So, you know, there was growing pains and kind of, I guess these kind of things are what new units experience, especially during a time of war.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And so they also have, because they have such, you know, they have such a history, you can, and you're always going to have the old and bold that, and rightly so, you know, they stick with the stuff that they know and then sort of developing through, and then you'll have new guys that join when it's brand new, and they kind of, yeah, they would have essentially, I suppose, teething problems. But then having said that, it's a busy time, so
right,
that wouldn't have lasted that long, and then you're straight out, you know, into the shit with everyone else. So,
right. Well, that's one thing he talked about, you know, in regards to, I asked him a question about, you know, did things change after their first rotation as MARSOC Marines? And he said, you know, some things change in terms of the training of like those core special operations skill sets. But he felt like they kind of figured it out on a team level, but some of the issues were kind of higher up in the chain of command,
yeah,
with, you know, some of the leadership doing things kind of the old way and not being used to this kind of new style of doing things, you know?
Yeah. And again, it's just taking, I suppose it's that everyone goes through those sorts of stages. Because I think he, if I remember rightly, didn't he come in after Fallujah? So he had to kind of face, you've got those guys who have been smashed and, you know, and basically, I don't know, we use the term bloodied, but Fallujah, that was a huge battle. So coming in on the back of something like that, it's always going to be tough. But again, with the rate of combat deployments, you know, people, it doesn't take long before you're the old sweat, you know, before you're the one that's sort of seeing the new guys come in. So,
right.
Yeah.
So kind of.
Oh, no, cool. I'm looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. And Pete's
doing and he's obviously got the new show and everything.
Right. He's doing a bunch of things, you know, like, I guess, you know, once he retired, he immediately transitioned into doing work in the defense sector. And now he got that show coming out. So it should be pretty good.
Yeah, no, cool. I look forward to that.
Yeah. And most people know by now there was a terrorist attack in Manchester over on your side of the world. 22 people were confirmed dead and I think 50 wounded with more, you know, people who are in, you know, on life support and that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. So. And I think that's the terrible thing is that it's horrible to say, but the number tends to rise, doesn't it?
Right.
When you have so many injured because, you know, the people fighting for their lives now, but the body can only do so much in particular with this type of, these type of injuries.
Right. And blast injuries are a pretty serious thing. And, you know, I know you've dealt with some of that during your operational service.
Sure. And that's the thing, like people don't realize it. I think they just think even when you see, guys are missing a limb or missing something, if they've been involved in a blast injury, they're going to have a lot of injuries, you know, that it doesn't just sort of, unless it's an EFP, it's not like a clean cut. And then they go through so many different stages. So you've got the primary injuries, which is like the, I don't want to talk too technically, but like the overpressure. So you have anywhere that's kind of hollows affected. So ears, eardrums go in. And I know these sound like people think, oh, eardrums, that's such a, that's a hideous injury to deal with. And especially if you still need to remain combat effective, because you can just imagine now both eardrums, you know, that they're gone. So, and that's before you've even faced anything that we would then necessarily see as, you know, life-threatening. Just, do you see what I'm saying? People would just think, oh, your ears, it's all good. But no, that's not good at all. And then you'd look at the sort of hollow organs that you have. So that's if you're kind of close, that's the primary injuries you're going to have. And that's generally for if you're fairly close to a blast. Then you've got the secondary injuries, which are projectiles, fragmentation injuries, and all the sort of problems that they can cause. And then you're looking at things like, in particular, sort of fragmentation wounds. If we've got quite large cavities in the body, and if you're going to be bleeding into them. So, and this kind of builds up quite a severe picture. So you, and then even moving on from there, you've got the tertiary injuries, which is where you get thrown against an object. So if you imagine, even in like a normal sort of road traffic collision, you've got the different collisions, you know, we all kind of know about that. But in a blast injury, you've got sort of add to that as well, add to the kind of injuries that you're going to see. They are really bad to deal with. And it's almost, you know, for example, you know, a friend of mine, Stu, he lost one leg, but he also had 11 other significant injuries. So, you know, you're looking at that. That's what you have to deal with. So as a medic, yeah. And again, I hate to say this, but it's never usually just one person.
In a blast situation.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so you look at then this like hideous situation where you've got the guy, I think, you know, he detonated in the foyer where people were waiting for their kids or, you know, and that's and it like made a real mess. So, and unless, and this is another thing, unless you're kind of trained for that sort of stuff, that's not a scene that you can just whip into and think and feel comfortable with. Unfortunately, I think, there are even like homeless guys and stuff helping. I'm not saying that just because they're homeless they wouldn't help, but I think it was a real sort of sign of I don't know, people like just doing what was right and getting stuck in. And more often than not, doing the basics, especially medically, doing the basics well, they would have saved lives. You know, so even down to the point of, I think one of the homeless lads I was listening to on the news today had said that him and another guy were just holding a woman's legs up because she must have been bleeding from somewhere. But whatever motion they did, I think it created some form of tourniquet effect. He didn't say exactly where she was bleeding from, but he said if they hadn't have done that, she would have bled out. So, you know, I just thought that was, if there was anything positive, that people did get amongst it and help.
Right, and some of that goes back to people having awareness and having some of the skills fall under the kind of TCCC guidelines.
Yeah. And I think people get a bit scared of, oh, we shouldn't have to know that. Well, that's great that we shouldn't, you know, and it kind of pisses me off because it's almost like an easy cop-out. Is a no, you know, we're not going to let people win, so we're not going to learn that. Well, to me, that's just a bit naive in this day and age, because regardless of, you could be pleasing everyone, someone will still be displeased. Right. You know, you could do all the right things in life and there's still going to be an asshole. It's still going to be someone who's having a bad day. So to learn those skills, and in particular, you know, if anything, if any of the sort of conflicts that we've been involved in, you know, along with the US and stuff, we have come on leaps and bounds medically. So I think it's a good, that needs to be shared. And if it involves you potentially going to do a one-day course to learn the very basics, then, you know, why not get on board?
Right, and it's just something, you know, if you have these skills, you know, you've never been in the military, you didn't work as a first responder, if you have these skills and, you know, you go to work every day and you have a book bag with you and you keep, you know, a small medical kit or at the very least a tourniquet in your bag, you become an asset to the community, you know, if something happens.
Even with a road traffic accident, you know, a kid gets run over, you know what? What would you rather? Or you came across something and someone's impaled on, you know, just by an accident. You know, I'd rather have the skills to do something than just stand and watch like somebody die. You know, I think that's tougher to deal with than having, like, attempted to help.
I saw this video, I think it was in Iran, if I'm not mistaken. And this guy, I think he robbed a bank or a store or something like that. And there was the people in the area were kind of keeping him from leaving. Like there was like a crowd and they were kind of blocking him off and he was trying to escape. And a police officer showed up and he ended up shooting him in the leg. And, you know, when you hear, you know, in the U.S. there's a big debate about, you know, are cops too aggressive and whatever. And then sometimes, like on social media, on some of these posts, you know, debating about if there's a cop right, was he wrong? You'll see people say things like, "Oh, well, they didn't have to kill him; they could just shoot him in the leg or something, right?" So this cop shoots this guy in the leg, and he's bleeding out, and he's actually dying. But you know, no one there has any medical training, so it wasn't until the guy was like on his last breath that some dude comes with a belt and ties the belt right above the wound to stop the blood flow. And it's just, you know, it's just that kind of thing is just an example.
Simple, simple little thing.
Right. And it's also, it just goes to show that how much people lack understanding of these matters, you know.
And that's not, you know, if you've got like a major bleed on a limb, they're probably the easiest bleeds to stop, you know, because you've got places you can, I mean, it is very basic anatomy and physiology. And there's only so many ways you can stop that bleed. You know, do you see what I'm saying? And you've got places you can put things that make it easy. It's when you've got problems on the trunk, you know, when you've got problems where you can't apply a improvised tourniquet and that makes it more problematic. And then again, like with these injuries, you can then also get, which is, you've got, so say, the initial injury, the secondary and then the tertiary. And then you've also got the injuries potentially of falling objects from the, you know, I mean, it is, it's a difficult scene to deal with. I'd say probably out of all of them, you know, blast scene is not great, is it? But again, if you get the basics right, you can't really go far wrong, because that's all you can do.
Right. And, you know, it's this situation is, I guess it's still developing, you know, the security services are going on raids, and I think they they arrested the bomber's brother, and I think I read something where they arrested his father as well in Libya.
Yeah, that was in Libya.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, we can like talk about that. It's basically, and obviously they've got military personnel on in sort of strategic areas now that is of importance. But I don't think that that's a bad thing. And I'd actually like to see a task force set up, that like a unit that does that, because I think if you had that, because of all of like the military's experience in conflict zones, it's far easier for us to ping someone who looks, you know, we have that very quite a famous phrase of absence of the normal, presence of the abnormal. So if we're looking at someone, you know, generally if someone's about to blow themselves up, they don't act normal, right? Because it's not a normal function in life, is it? Even if you're drug crazed, there's still little telltale signs. And I think it wouldn't hurt to have, again, just like we pass on our medical knowledge, that knowledge is, you know, extremely important to pass on also. So who knows, that could make it, you know, this troops on the streets, there's potential for having something a bit more permanent. I don't mean obviously patrolling the streets. I just mean in particular the capital. You know, that, I don't think that's a bad thing to have a task force that's their job.
Right.
Because then they could work alongside the police. And then again, it's, you know, it's assisting the police in what they have to do, because you can't sort of watch everywhere. You know, it's a big old task, isn't it?
Right. You can't defend every single attack, but, you know, and then it's also kind of interesting because this guy had traveled to Libya before, you know, he did this, and it just makes you wonder why are people going to these places and allowed to come back and not get questioned? You know, what are you doing in Libya?
That's,
you know?
Exactly, because there's nothing, especially in places that are at the moment, you know, completely unstable. And Libya is unstable. Syria, clearly that's unstable. So if you are traveling to those places and you're not checked in, you know, you're not contracted, you're not doing something that's kind of that you're allowed to do, then I don't see the problem in being questioned when you get back. That is not an infringement on anyone's liberties. That's common sense. So sometimes, and as I would never sort of blame our security services, because a lot of the time their hands are tied. But
I
do think that it's a strange thing to, when I hear these numbers, and I'm not one to, unless I kind of know things factually, but I hear numbers about how many people have returned from having fought in Syria, now that they've come home, it's like that's crazy.
Yeah, it's troubling,
that's fucking nuts.
But it's also true what you say. You know, like, you know, we're not, you know, who knows what they're doing, and you know the information they have, and I'm sure in some cases their hands are tied by some of these laws and you know things like that. But again, it is a little troubling. You know, there's Westerners traveling to these places. And these aren't
for what purpose?
Yeah, these aren't vacation spots. Like, you're not going diving off the fucking coast of Syria, you know? Like, it's
no, you're not. You're not, John.
Yeah, I gotta cancel my fucking trip.
It's something that certainly needs to be addressed. And at the obviously at the moment in the UK, it's just gone from everything was crazy with the election to now. Obviously, this has happened, and then I don't know what. We're living in a strange time, aren't we? Because, and this is again another interesting thing. I wasn't shocked. I didn't feel like, because I was up quite late doing something else on my Facebook page, and then I seen the sort of newsreels, and I wasn't shocked. I didn't sit there and think, you know, I was obviously I felt angry and felt those emotions, but there was no shock in me. I didn't feel any like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. Cause it's, you know, it's almost one of those things that it's not, if it's going to happen, it's when, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. But
that's how we are now. That's just almost, Europe's been hit quite a lot. And I think we've been very lucky. And most of that's been down to the way our security services have been able to track and deal with people. But I remember he's no longer the head of MI6, but the former head of MI6, and he hit the nail on the head by saying, you know, they have to get lucky once, we get lucky every time. You know, so that's just almost that guy slipped through the net and then caused mayhem.
Right, and you know, it's a it is an enemy that isn't wearing a uniform, so it's a different fight.
It's different, isn't it?
Yeah, and you can't, like you said, you can't stop everybody. You know, you hope that you can, for the most part, stop it. And I think for the most part, they do.
Yeah.
But, you know, once in a while, someone is going to slip through the cracks. Yeah. And I think it's just the reality of the enemy that, you know, we face. And, you know, people react, you know, to these things. And some of the more conservative types from America, UK, or whatever, you know, say, oh, you know, close the borders and that kind of thing. And it's just, it's hard to say what the solution would be, you know.
Well, yeah, because this kid was born in Manchester. So in some ways, you know, it's almost like close the borders. Well, they're already here.
Right.
The enemies are generally, they're all, you know, if this is, it's one, like you said, it's extremely hard to fight. But I do think that kid was born in Manchester, but he did travel certain places. By all accounts, he was flying an ISIS flag out of his window. You know, it's,
I mean, that's crazy. Like, if
it's like, come on, yeah.
If I'm walking down the street and I see an ISIS flag.
Yeah, I'd report it. And we all have a responsibility. This isn't just down to police, security services, military. Everyone has a responsibility. And it's more often than not, it's always very easy to just say, oh, well, it's like with, we've been going through this outrage of grooming gangs, and it's disgusting what the stuff that's been going on. You know, we had a program that was recently aired in the UK, and over 1,400 youngsters have, you know, been systematically abused at the hands of grooming gangs that are, I think, they're predominantly from Pakistani origins. So, but again, the kids that were being abused were already, they were quite vulnerable young adults or young kids. So they're already not wanting to be in their homes and therefore found their ways or way into the clutches. And what's worse is that these kids, they go voluntarily because they're already in sort of shit state. And then they just, and you know what happens then, you know, if you've got a vulnerable kid, it's easy. They're far easier to be manipulated.
Right. And you can
exactly. Yeah. But that, my point is that you know, I sometimes drive down in streets where I live, and I do keep an eye out and think, if I see something weird, then it takes you 2 minutes to report it. And it might be, you know, a bit boring, or you feel like, you know, you don't want to do it, but you should.
Yeah. Because that should, you just don't.
Yeah, exactly. And you should, you know, it is down to us all to, you know, sort of muck in. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the ramifications are of this. I'm sure it will go through the normal process of people are angry, emotional, and then, but we need to have, I think, some changes in things. You know, I think that's it's coming to a head where there needs to be, for instance, this bit about he traveled back from Libya, that needs to not go unnoticed.
Right.
You know, and I do think that all it could have taken was potentially, as he crosses the border back in, why have you been to Libya? You know, what was your business there? And then a quick check on this guy, you know, I think that things like that need to change. And I don't think it's us being PC. I think it's actually there's certain laws that have come from the European Court of Human Rights, you know, that we've got our hands tied a little bit here. And it needs to change.
Well, right. That's the issue, is that, you know, there are laws, you know, the US Constitution over in the UK as well. It's like you have human rights, and there are certain rights that you shouldn't have violated, but in some situations, I think we need to say, hey, you know,
needs to be something.
Enemy
is
using that against us, and
they
aren't fighting us, you know, overtly. They're fighting us covertly, and they're using our own system and laws and constitution against us.
And it's clever. It's very clever.
It's very clever. Yeah. It's very clever. And it's the only way you can fight the West. You can't fight any other way, because you would just lose. And
you would lose.
And there's well-documented conversations that people have had with, you know, high-ranking terrorists who were caught, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he was doing all kind of stuff prior to 9/11, you know, all around the world, in the Philippines, in Afghanistan, setting
active.
Up things, you know, funding this or whatever, you know, setting up training camps and
buying a new Lamborghini and, you know, mid-month. Right. It's true, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he was handing a lot of money, and
yeah,
they, you know, they interrogated him, you know, very successfully. You know, some of the information that he gave up led to captures of high-level terrorists and and whatever. So one of the things he ended up saying is that we're not going to fight the West. We're not going to win on the battlefield, per se. But the way we are going to win is we're going to immigrate to your countries. We're going to, you know, go through that process, you know, get elected.
It's a long game.
It's a long game. And he said eventually, you know, the laws that you guys have and the, you know, people who are going to stand up and say, you know, human rights, this and constitution, that it's going to work against you. And in some ways we're seeing that happen. So,
yeah, so it's like unfolding.
Right.
And I remember, it's so, and again, with all of the way that I see conversations unfolding on social media, like people are at each other's throats because, and we're almost now blinded by our own thoughts, you know, so I'll see like an argument develop and you can see that someone could write like a whole statement on trying to justify what they're saying. And then the next person will come back, will not have read what they've said and just come out with their own version of that. And it goes on. And it's just like, hang on. And it's almost like you're just seeing people cut and paste now from textbooks. And I think, well, but the reality is I'm not even sure that a lot of people are getting ground truth.
No.
You know, and you see like all of a sudden we've got these experts in field from their war room in their lounges.
Yeah.
It's like, well, hang on. Have you ever actually even been stepped foot outside of your fucking house?
Yeah. And
it drives me insane.
Yeah. And another thing I saw a lot of, and some organizations kind of pointed this out, was after the attack, like all these kind of fake stories about it were popping up, like, you know, on social media, like, oh, you know, my son was killed, da da da, and like all this fake stuff.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be fake because they, you know, they located the original pictures and, you know.
How crazy is that?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to sound like, you know, a fucking conspiracy theorist, but.
But who's doing that? Yeah.
I wonder if it's not a foreign government, you know, just trying to cause chaos, you know what I mean?
Hey, we all watched Homeland, didn't we?
Exactly. And I mean, Homeland was like, yo, this shit is Homeland, going down. Like,
And he's, just talking about that was a really, I think that was the best season. I know some of it's far-fetched, but it keeps me, I'm just gutted about Quinn.
Oh, yeah. When I saw that, because I like to wait and let the episodes build up so I could binge watch. And when I saw that, I was like, no fucking way, man. This guy was like,
Quinn.
Yeah.
And it was just eerily close to what's going on in the world.
Honestly,
so how do they know?
It's weird how Homeland does that. Like, it's weird.
I know. It's messed up, but it's really good. And I know, like I say, it's not, it's a little bit far-fetched, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's quite sharply done. I like, it keeps you thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. All good stuff.
But we'll see. So let's hope that we get some, I don't know, something positive comes out of it. So there's some sort of change that we can, let's respond by doing something that it's like another step to negating the next attack. So if it is a case of, if you travel to, you know, have a list of countries, if you travel to these countries, and there's no, and it doesn't matter what religion you are. If you as an individual go to this country, and your explanation is not satisfactory, you know, you're going to be open to further questioning, or at least, you know, or potentially, I mean, even looking at things like having another task force that's just employed to watch people, or do you see what I'm saying? So you know, you have, because you have really highly skilled people, and I don't want to sound like derogatory. I'd probably put myself into the bracket of I don't mind watching people because I'm not an MI6 agent. That MI6 agent needs to be somewhere doing their important shit. So the stuff that they potentially don't want to be doing could be done by someone who is less qualified, but still obviously has that role. And I think, I don't know, maybe that's what's needed, you know, to have a new role to help, to kind of like support officers, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. I think
so. Creating a job for myself almost.
Yeah, there we go. Maybe MI6 is going to show up at your house and go, hey.
No, yeah, probably not for that. But I don't know. I'd like to think that we can put something in place that's just going to help or make it harder for the next attack. because unfortunately there will be another one, whether it's, you know, that's the nature of what we're fighting.
Right. And it's just, you know, keep your head on a swivel, you know.
Just got to keep, we've got to keep on keeping on, you know, and just, you know, I hope the people that, you know, that fell, you know, didn't suffer so much, and you just got to hope that people can kind of find a way through, you know. It's because I think, again, with all the way social media goes, is we tend to forget that there's someone that's grieving, you know, because we want to sort of get our opinions across, and right. And rightly as we do, but again, then there's someone sat at home right now in shit state because they've just lost their kid, their mum, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Sometimes, you know. Yeah. But I see they're a little bit up in arms because of the New York Times. Did you see that? I've seen that tonight.
What?
With reference, I think they printed leaked pictures of forensic stuff from the bombing site.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, I didn't see that. Yeah.
Well, there you go, John. Have a look at that. We'll chat about that next time.
Yeah, Americans love leaking shit.
Yeah, let's just leak it out there. But so we look forward to hearing from Pete now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, cool. So with that being said, now I'll play the conversation that I had with Pete Perry. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I am on with former Marine Raider Pete Perry. Pete, what's up, brother?
Not too much, man. Thanks for having me, John. I'm pumped. How are you?
I'm good, man. Just working nonstop, man. How about you?
Same, dude. It's every day is a hustle, and just getting excited for this TV show, and just I'm excited to be here. So thank you again for having me.
Yeah. So talking about the TV show, we're definitely going to talk about that. I guess later on, but let's start from the beginning, Pete, and
sure.
Let's talk about what kind of motivated you to join the military, and then if we could kind of, you know, go through some of those details from early on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I joined the Marine Corps in July of 2003. Prior to that, I was not your typical kind of A student. I was more your kind of D's and F student, really big into skateboarding, punk rock. And I just knew that college really wasn't for me. I knew had I gone at that time, I would have wasted a lot of money and a lot of time. My dad was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, so I was very familiar with the military lifestyle. And just after talking to both my parents, like, hey, man, maybe college isn't for you yet. How about you look into the military? So initially, I looked into the Air Force, sat down. I wanted to be a PJ. You know, I worked through the whole thing with the Air Force recruiter. And a little bit through, all the way up actually until MEPS, I was really excited about it. But something was kind of off about the recruiter, which actually turned me off for the Air Force. So I actually left MEPS in the middle of in-processing, went home. The Air Force recruiter called my house phone. Hey, Pete, what are you doing? I thought you were in, man. I'm like, not for me, man. I'm done. Hung up the phone. My hand's still on the house phone. Phone rings. Hello. Hey, this is Sergeant So-and-so, United States Marine Corps. Have you ever thought about joining the military? And I'm like, as a matter of fact, I have. And he's like, oh, sure, man. And I'm like, no, I'm serious. Like, I'm super into joining the military. And he's like, all right, what's your address? I'll be right over. Like an hour and a half later, dude showed up to my house, full dress blues. And we talked through the whole thing. And then at that point in 2002, my dad was actually in Saudi Arabia, sitting in some bunker during the initial part of Afghanistan for planning and coordination. So we had to send over waivers to him since I was 17 at the time. He signed that. We got everything back. And then that was summer of 2002, and then I went into boot camp July of 2003, and that's how it all started, man.
Awesome. So, okay, so you joined fairly young then.
Yeah.
So you kind of grew up in the Marine Corps.
Yeah, definitely. So I was 18 years old when I went to boot camp, and I've learned a lot since then. And, you know, you definitely grow up really, really, really quick in the military.
Right. So Afghanistan was underway as you joined. And obviously there was a bit of a difference in how things run in the military during peacetime versus during wartime. I'm going to imagine that in wartime, things move a lot faster. What initially, as you signed up, what was your job and your specialty?
Sure. So when I initially joined, I had the plan of like, hey, I'll go serve my country. I'll do 4 years and then I'm going to get out. So I wanted a profession or a skill set in the Marine Corps that would translate into the civilian marketplace. So my recruiter duped me, like most of them do, and said, hey, you know, you could be a radio operator, you could be a satellite communications specialist and get out and go get a good job for like AT&T or Sprint. And I'm, you know, I'm 18. I'm like, well, that sounds cool. Sign me up, dude. So went to boot camp, finished that. And then I went to Marine combat training and then I went to comm school. And as I'm leaving, Marine combat training, they're like, all right, you know, 0621 Perry, which is Marine Corps, you're a field radio operator. And I'm like, whoa, hold on, Big Sarge. I'm doing satellite communications. I'm going to go work for AT&T. And he's like, the fuck you are, man. Get on this bus. You're going to 29 Palms. And I started, it's a field radio operator course, FROC. And the day that I got there, I was like, oh man, I made the worst mistake ever. And it's nothing against radio operators, but it just wasn't what I thought that the Marine Corps was going to be. It was a big time wake up call. And at that point I wasn't desperate to find something new. And I actually remember a gunny from 2nd Force Reconnaissance came out. He gave a quick speech on recon and they talked about what it was. And then I actually missed the indoc while at comm school. I actually blew it off to go skateboard with me and a really good friend of mine. And then I came back from a snowboarding trip. Walking out of the snowboard, and there's one of the instructors. His name was Corporal Trey Hardinger. Trey saw me walk with a snowboard. We started shooting the shit, and then he had jump wings. And I'm like, "Hey, man, what are those jump wings about?" So he tells me, he's like, "Yeah, he was a radio operator with 3rd Recon Battalion." So he tells me like what reconnaissance Marines do, and I was like, "Oh man, I missed this indoc. I totally fucked up. I missed the best shot in the world to get away from this job." As luck should have it, there were 4 slots from my graduating class to go to 3rd Recon Battalion. Trey hooked it up, and I actually got orders of 3rd Recon Battalion, showed up in March 2004. I was in the comm shop for all of like a week and a half in like the regular Marine Corps. And then I took the indoc there to become a reconnaissance Marine. So yeah, I was in the Marine Corps for probably about a week and a half, took the indoc, and that next week I checked into Alpha Company, 3rd Reconnaissance Battalion.
And there's a selection process to get into the recon, right?
A little bit. So you'll take an initial screener. When I was coming up, it was just like a day-long event. Prior, I guess the previous generation, you're talking like a day, two, or longer type of a, you know, indoctrination event. So mine was, it's kind of like a modified physical fitness test. There's some swimming, there's some rucking. So I made that, and then while you're waiting to go to, so you go to RIP. So you become what's called a roper. It's more of an affectionate type term you're a recon Marine awaiting training, essentially. So I was a roper from March of 04 until the end of June of 04. And then I checked into basic reconnaissance course in Coronado, California in July of 2004.
And for the audience, I mean, a lot of the audience is somewhat familiar with some of these units, like the reconnaissance Marines. And so what exactly is it that the reconnaissance Marines do? Is it like a kind of like advanced infantry style unit?
So I would say you're pretty spot on. It's a pretty light infantry unit with a jump and dive insert capabilities, sniper capabilities. They're really the eyes and ears for the Marine Corps. And that's going to be the reconnaissance, battalion reconnaissance and force reconnaissance companies.
Right, and just as kind of my question to you, I was always kind of curious about this. What is the difference between the two different kind of recon, like the force reconnaissance and battalion?
Sure. So the reconnaissance battalion will traditionally work for the MEF or the MU, and then that's where you've got the force reconnaissance units are generally more senior guys. So they're guys that have been a reconnaissance Marine for a few years. They've usually done a couple deployments. And I actually remember going from 3rd Recon Battalion to 1st Force Reconnaissance Company. I was already a Recon Marine and then still taking an indoc to go to a platoon. So it was kind of the next step up. So.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, and then, you know, you, throughout your career, you became a Marine Raider. You know, there's some historical, there's some history behind the name Marine Raider that dates back to World War II. But the Marine Raiders stood up during the middle of this kind of global war on terror. And I think they just recently made, like, what, 11 years or so, 12 years as a unit?
Yep. Yes. So it was actually really cool. I'm super fortunate. Right place, right time. I was actually at 1st Force Recon Company. We were in 4th Platoon, and we were up in Hawthorne, Nevada. We were going through a light weapons package, some mobility. So we're driving around up in the mountains in the desert, and we were on our way back. And it was just a really kind of informal thing of like, hey, you guys are in MARSOC now. The Marine Corps is finally in U.S. SOCOM, which was a pretty big surprise to us, because not too long before that, they had disbanded DET 1 or Detachment 1. So, and that was kind of the trial group of guys. So, again, very senior force reconnaissance Marines pulled into DET 1. They did a tremendous job and really laid the framework. But it was one of those things where, Donald Rumsfeld at the time, you know, again, the way it's trickled down to us, didn't really give the Marine Corps too much of a decision. They're like, hey, this, you know, the GWAT's not going anywhere. You guys need to pony up some guys and get into US SOCOM. So it was a really unique time to be around.
Right. And SOCOM is the Special Operations Command. But
yep.
Up until MARSOC was stood up, the Marine Corps didn't have a component in SOCOM.
That's correct. Yep, that's correct. So you had the Force Recon, even the MUs, the Marine Expeditionary Units, would kind of advertise that they were, you know, SOC capable. But no one in the Marine Corps was a no kidding SOCOM detachment. So it was a really, really big time for us in the Marine Corps.
Right. And so all of the first units that were that made up MARSOC, who were now a part of SOCOM, all came from the reconnaissance battalions, right?
That is, yep, 100% correct. So they took and disbanded 1st and 2nd Force Recon Company, and they stood up 1st and 2nd, at the time, was Marine Special Operations Battalions. Now it's 1st and 2nd and 3rd Raider Battalions, and we'll cover that more later on. But, yeah, it was a really, really unique time to be around. That was 2006. So at that point, you know, we were still training to go to Iraq at that point, as MARSOC stood up. And then you had the East Coast Company, the 1st East Coast Company is Fox Company. They were in Afghanistan. They were doing great things. And then pretty much some bad PR ended up getting them booted out of country, of which now everything's been exonerated. Those guys are totally innocent. They did the right thing. You guys can actually look it up. So it's the Fox Company 2006 incident in Afghanistan. Which again had, you know, some pretty big lasting effects on us on the West Coast. For example, our pre-deployment speech from the component commander at the time, no kidding, he and his entourage walked into our training space and said, hey, you guys fuck this up. It's going away. Don't fuck this up. And then he walked out and we're like, all right, man, no pressure there. Yeah. Yeah. Don't fuck this up. I'm like, all right, cool. So
did you go on a deployment before you joined MARSOC or no?
I did, yeah. So when I was with 3rd Recon Battalion, I went to Fallujah, Iraq from March until October of 2005. So we were actually in Zaidan. So it's a little bit out of Fallujah proper, and, you know, spent a long time there. It wasn't kinetic at all. I think we got in one, like, you know, 2-minute gunfight, if that. We actually spent the majority of the time kind of doing presence patrols, counter IED, cache sweeps. We were a glorified line platoon. When I say line, we're like a glorified infantry platoon. We were doing probably 3 or 4 foot patrols a day per team. And then we would do a raid at night, and just for, you know, 9 months, man, just nonstop.
And that was right after the big battle of Fallujah?
It was. So it was, you know, during that workup cycle. Prior to us getting there, you know, everyone's watching the news and everyone's just getting really excited, kind of frothing at the mouth for this massive, you know, gunfights that we're going to get into. And it's going to be this really kinetic environment. And we got there and it wasn't, man. And it was really disappointing at the time. you know, I remember thinking just like, and you go out, you know, fortunately I've always had really good leadership and you always go out, you know, like you treat every mission like it's your first. And, you know, that way, you know, to kind of avoid that complacency. But man, every single time we're like, all right, maybe it's going to happen today. Maybe it's going to happen today. And it just never came for that entire deployment. It just never happened.
Right. And it's probably so weird for you guys, especially right after that humongous fight. And then, I mean, I think it was probably just that area for you guys, right? Because I think the rest of Iraq was pretty kinetic at the time.
A little bit. It was starting to ramp up. Depending on where you were, it was definitely ramping up. So I know we were there, I believe, if my brain serves me correct, that was right. We were kind of in between, you know, Big Fallujah and Big Ramadi. Okay. And right around that time, you know, for us, it wasn't kinetic.
Right, because it went from Fallujah to Ramadi, right? Is that how it kind of...
Yep. Yeah, so I think they did. It was two big pushes into Fallujah, and then it was into Ramadi.
Yeah, and then Ramadi kind of had elements from the Army, Marines, and I believe Naval Special Warfare was there, you know, kind of made famous by Chris Kyle and you know, some of the things that they were doing over there at that time.
Yep.
So after you it was after you returned from your first rotation, and that's when you went into MARSOC, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the timeline would be came back from Fallujah in October of 05, and then I checked into First Force in, I think it was probably February of 2006. And then we were just, like I said, we were going through our workup or through our pre-deployment training cycle, and then we got a phone call. Hey, you guys are in US SOCOM. You guys are MARSOC, Marine Special Operations Command. So the rest of our workup, we had trained to go to Iraq. For most of us, you know, that would have been my second time there. And most of the guys in the platoon, that would have been second, third, probably one guy, maybe fourth time going back during that time. So.
And did that change anything in regards to how the training was happening? You know, when they called up and said, hey, you guys are now in MARSOC, did that change some of the training for you guys, like your workup?
No, not at the time. I mean, we were the force reconnaissance companies set, you know, super high standards, whether shooting, patrolling, jumping, diving, whatever those guys are doing, they're going to do at a very comparable level to other soft units within US SOCOM. So there wasn't really too much to go on at that time, you know, and I'll get into it in later on deployments. You know, there was a lot that we didn't know at that time. So in terms of, we kind of looked at it, hey, we're going to go to Iraq. We'll be more of like a direct action, you know, hard knock type force. And then, you know, we're getting ready to deploy. We ended up going to the Philippines for about a 45-day JSET. So we were out there training some of the Philippine Marines, getting ready to go to Iraq. And then probably a couple weeks out, hey, we're switching. We're going to go to Afghanistan. And we'll just, you know, more to follow. So we got on a plane, flew out of the Philippines, and then we landed in Kandahar in spring of 2007.
Okay, and you guys, you got to Kandahar and, you know, start running operations, or did you guys have to bounce around a little bit?
No, so we got there, and it was still one of those things where, you know, to the Special Operations Task Force, like, hey, cool, we have these guys, you know, and then it was like, how are we going to employ these guys? So we probably spent the first maybe 2 weeks in country, you know, we're putting our vehicles together, we're getting all of our weapons, getting everything ready, you know, we're training day in, day out, getting ready to go out and start conducting missions. We'd probably been there in Kandahar for about 2-3 weeks, and then we got orders to go to FOB Price, right in vicinity of Goresh. So we took Highway 1 going west. So we left Kandahar, drove in the middle of the night, and got out to FOB Price, where we set up our FOB. And then same thing there. We, you know, we started to build our camp at that point. And there was already a 7th Group team there. And then there's a pretty large British footprint there as well.
7th Special Forces, like Army Green Berets, you mean?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So at that time in MARSOC's history, we needed to have adult supervision. So, so, you know, it was one of those things where we actually split our elements. So their senior element of their team would go out with, I guess, the more junior element of our team, and then vice versa. Hmm. So, you know, our first mission, We were actually in the middle of training, and we got a phone call that there was an Army Special Forces team was in contact. I think they had one US KIA and maybe another wounded. And we were to go be their quick reaction force, their QRF. And this was a massively eye-opening experience just to really see like how, you know, vast this country was and how far away people really were when things went bad. I think it took us maybe 2.5-3 hours to drive there to get to those guys. And by the time we got there, I was pretty much done and over with. But that was a big time eye-opener of just, oh man, if things get weird here, you're pretty much on your own.
Right. And you guys were driving there. That's why it took so long.
Yep. Correct.
Right. And the thing in Afghanistan, I guess, is a unique place in the regards that I believe it's the most heavily mined country on the planet, if I'm not mistaken. So you got like the legacy mines left by the Russians, and then you have all the IEDs left by the Taliban and the other groups that are out there fighting. So just driving around there is a risk in itself.
Yeah, it's super sketchy. I know during that 2007 deployment, we lost a handful of trucks. You know, we were hitting old Russian legacy anti-tank mines. You know, the Taliban they're smart, man. A lot of guys will kind of talk shit that, oh, they live in a cave, man. They don't know what they're doing. I'll be the first to tell you that a handful of those guys really know what's going on, and they're actually pretty formidable opponents. I mean, there's been a handful of times where we've been duking it out, and you actually see them run the same tactics that you were taught and trained on you, and you're like, oh shit, this is going to be an interesting day. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was actually having a conversation with some friends of mine, and we were talking about things like that, you know, how hard is it, you know, like there was a that terrorist attack last night in Manchester, and
yeah,
and someone made a comment like, oh, it's, you know, it's not that hard to, you know, strap a bomb to your chest or whatever, you know, it takes balls, but it's not hard to do it. And I'm like, these dudes are smart, like they're not like... you know, you think these guys are just like cavemen or whatever. I mean, these dudes been fighting for a long time. And what I said was, is I know, you know, a lot of guys, you know, like yourself, how you just said, like, who say, yeah, these dudes are not, you know, just somebody you can just write off. Like, they know what they're doing, you know? And yeah. A lot of people seem to have that misconception. Like, you see it a lot on social media and stuff like that. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, don't get me wrong. You definitely have that low hanging fruit. The guy that's just, you know, right. He's your super little henchman. He's going to go out and just do kind of menial tasks. He'll probably be the first guy to get smoked. Right. But dude, don't get me wrong. There are some guys that are doing some really, pretty gnarly things out there. So, and that we learned that in 2007. So, I mean, we did that QRF, got back, and that was, like I said, I mean, eye opener for sure. And then after that, we were pretty much just a really big, glorified infantry platoon. We would go out half of, at the time we were called the DASTR platoon, the Direct Action Surveillance Reconnaissance platoon. So we were about a 50 man plussed up platoon. We just split in half. So my half would go out with the senior half of the ODA. So we'd go out with their team commander and a handful of their guys. We'd probably leave the FOB in about 4 to 6 gun trucks. And we'd pick a village. Hey, this is our village of interest. We have a compound or two that we want to check out. And no shit, as we would be driving up, you know, they would immediately start to report on us. So we would use different tactics. So we would actually put different color flags on some of the antennas of the trucks, and then we could listen to their radio. So they're like, hey, we're going to shoot a rocket at the truck with a red flag. And you're like, oh, shit, that's my truck. Oh, shit. Oh, shit. All right, brace yourself, man. It's coming. And then sure shit, you know, a couple seconds later, RPG would come screaming overhead. And you're like, all right, they can definitely see us. And we were just doing movement to contact. That's all it was for that majority of that deployment. You know, we'd pick a village, pick a town, Kali Gaz, Hyderabad, Regay, Kajaki, Musa Kalay, and we would just drive down there, and we would spend 2 to 5 to 10 days down there just fighting all day long. And it was kind of funny, and we would joke like the old Bugs Bunny cartoons where you've got, you know, the wolf and the sheep, and at a certain point like the whistle blows and they take a lunch break. It was kind of like that on some of the hotter days. You'd be fighting, and it would just kind of die down. You're like, huh, it's kind of weird. And then we'd back off in the desert, take off kit, drink food, redistribute ammo, call on resupplies, and then sure shit, you know, we'd start taking indirect fire, we'd start taking mortars or rockets. And then that was the whistle, boop, you know, clock back in, and then just keep fighting all day. Right. So, and that's how that entire deployment went. And it was really good. It was really cool to kind of see, you know, yeah, granted, we're really far away from everybody, but the air power that we had was phenomenal. I mean, we were running AC-130 Spectre gunships dry regularly, B-1 bombers dry. And when I say running them dry, I mean, they were going home with no ordnance left. And we killed, I think during that deployment, we killed, it was like 340-something dudes. We had a good trip.
And so a lot of soft units, they would have like Air Force guys attached to them to kind of fill that role. Was that the same thing for you guys on that deployment?
So on that deployment, we didn't have a specific JTAC attached to us. We had JTACs internal to us that were just regular Marine reconnaissance guys that had gone to the course and been certified and had the same credentials as an Air Force combat controller. Now, granted, they're, you know, we're not going through the crazy pipeline that those guys, and I don't want to take anything away from those guys. Those guys are tremendous and have a very difficult job. But it's the same thing in SOF. You know, it's the jack of all trades, master of none. So we had a handful of actual JTACs in each team, and those guys were able to call in CAS. And at that time, you know, given we didn't have crazy rules of engagement, you know, at that time it was just the ground force commander. So whoever the senior guy on the ground, whether that was a captain or a major, could authorize, you know, whatever ordnance we wanted at the time. So it was great. We had great freedom of movement and a lot of autonomy. And it was a really cool time to be there.
Right, and having those type of rules of engagements that allows you guys to fight freely versus what ended up kind of happening later on, where the rules kind of restricted guys a lot, and from what I understand, people were killed in some situations because of it, or because you weren't allowed to take the initiative, I guess.
Yeah, you know, you definitely hear those stories, and I think part of it too, you know. It's really nice and convenient to, you know, you're in a gunfight just to kind of firm up and then call in a couple F-15s and drop a few 500 pounders. But at the same time, I personally think you send a much deeper psychological meaning when you actually close with and destroy your enemy at close range, you know, because then the next time when their buddies come to, you know, come recover them and then you kill them. And then now their buddies are really thinking like, man, you know what, do I want to do this?
Right.
You know, so that was kind of our message. You know, every deployment I ever did to Afghanistan was, you know, they have a little bit of a psychological hold on us with whether we're pressure plates or legacy mines or whatever it was, or just fighting in their backyard. Our goal was to just send that psychological terror of just killing these dudes as up close and as personal as humanly possible.
Right. And that got to be a little demoralizing to, you know, have your team for them on that side, having your team just dropping left and right in a gunfight, you know.
Oh, well, man, we'd hear it over the radios. Like, oh, it's the wolves. The men with beards are back. The men, you know, and then we'd listen to them on the radio. Oh, the men with beards are back. And then you could kind of hear it, you know, and there'd be other times where we would be patrolling and we, you know, again, we're monitoring what they're saying. And they're just using like regular radios that you can go buy from Radio Shack. So it's not like we're doing anything crazy. Right. And you would hear guys whisper like, they're very close to me. They're on top of us. I'm so scared. I'm so scared. And the other guy would be yelling at him, shoot, shoot, shoot. And the guy just wouldn't do anything. So yeah, the psychological part, it was absolutely, it's imperative, man. When you're fighting this type of an enemy, you know, you're fighting this guerrilla type warfare, it has to be violent. It has to be gruesome to send a message.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, so you guys came home from that first trip and, you know, obviously as a brand new special operations unit, there will be a lot of changes and lessons learned and, you know, in some cases, unfortunately, for the type of job that it is, a lot of lessons are learned in blood. Did things change for you guys after that deployment or after some other teams came home from their deployments and, you know, kind of sharing lessons and that kind of thing?
Absolutely, man. So we came back fall of 2007. Everybody took probably, you know, 20, 30 days vacation, came back to work. And they sat us in a conference room and said, hey, you guys are an Alpha company. We're going to stand up Delta company, first MSOB. Who wants to go on a deployment? So I think everybody but like one or two guys raised their hands. And those guys had prior commitments. One was going to go be a sniper school instructor. And I think the other guy was getting out. And they're like, all right, everybody with their hands raised, you guys are now in Delta company. And we're like, all right, well, that was easy. So we started our work up again. And this is where it got really cool. This is where a lot of the core soft skills we started to learn. And, you know, again, kind of being the new guys on the blocks, you know, and we went on that first deployment in 2007 of, hey, we're the new guys, we're the new kids in town. Dude, we'll wash windows. Just put us in the fight, coach, and we'll fucking work.
Right.
And I think that worked out really well. So then during this time, you know, we proved ourselves, MARSOC, you know, hey, we're good. We're going to stick around for at least another couple more deployments. So then this is where everyone's eyes were really opened of like, oh man, there's some really cool things out there that we're now able to do that we now have certain authorities to do that you don't have in battalion or force reconnaissance units. So we started to work on a lot of that stuff, the core soft, I guess, you know, more specialized training. And then we went back on another deployment, 2009. We went to FOB Robinson in Sangin. We went to Camp Delaram, my team. So it was MSOT 8142. We were hanging out at FOB Delaram, doing our thing. And then the night before our first mission, we got a phone call. Hey, guys, stand down. An Army SF team has had a couple casualties. We're going to reroute you guys to FOB Rob. So pack a bag. You guys will probably only be there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we'll bring you back to Delaram, and then your deployment will continue from there. So we packed everything up. And then a lot of us, knowing that Sangin area from the previous deployment in 2007, we were really excited. We knew it was going to be highly kinetic and a really fun trip. So packed up our bags, threw them in our trucks, and we drove from Delaram out to FOB Robinson right there in Sangin. And like I said, we'd packed enough. I think everyone was allowed 2 bags. So we'd had packed for a couple of weeks. And then that'll come in handy here in a little bit by the end of the story with that. So, and Sangin, man, it's definitely the Wild West out there. You're very, very much alone and isolated. There was a British cop just north of us, FOB Nolay, or COP Nolay. So, and that was it, man, for Sangin.
And you worked with the Brits at all, or were you just kind of based around them at certain times?
We were just based around them, just south of them at FOB Rob. More mutually supporting elements. If they were going to do something and they needed some kind of coverage or blockage, we would provide that, and then they would also help support us. And then we would also try and get some of our supplies up on a lot of their supply convoys. And every time, I think we did that 2 or 3 times, and every single time, I mean, those convoys were just ambushed and just decimated, to the point where we had thought one of our supply clerks had put our remaining bags. So again, hey guys, go to FOB Rob for 2 to 3 weeks, pack 2 bags. And now we'd been there for a couple months. Hey, let's, you know, send out all of our stuff. So we had thought the supply clerk packed everything, and then there was one giant shipping container that was just a burning pile of rubble at this point. And we had thought that, oh man, all of our shit was burned on this convoy, and we just lost all of our stuff. Oh, wow. So, and then, because at that point, I mean, we were getting mail maybe like once a month, once every like 5 to 6 weeks, just because it was an extremely kinetic environment. I think on average for the entire time we were at FOB Rob, I think we got attacked every other day. You know, they had killed a couple of our guards. So it was always, you know, you'd go out and fight and run around, and then you'd come back, and then you were still very much on guard. And you are anyway, you know what I mean? You're in Afghanistan. You've got host nation workers walking around, so you're still kind of iffy. And then you have your partner nation force, not too far from where you're living. So you're still on guard a lot, but you know, there was no room for complacency. I mean, we had snipers shooting and killing our guards. So it was an interesting deployment for sure.
Right. And at that time, you guys were already working with Afghan military, or?
Yeah. So at that time, we were working with, you know, stand up Afghan National Army guys. I think we had a group of about 30 to 50 guys, depending on what was going on. And at that time, it was actually pretty relaxed. You know, we would only have to take out 5 of them every mission. And I was one of the primary mentors or trainers for those guys. So that's where it's kind of cool, you know, being a young soft operator. You know, you're in charge of basically your own little army, from everything from food to housing to weapons to training, to and then being responsible for them on a very kinetic battlefield. So it's pretty unique experiences for sure.
And was this one of the aspects that was new to you guys as MARSOC Marines?
Not too much. More of the, you know, being responsible for every, you know, every little bit about these guys. That was the newer part. Okay. When we were in Iraq, we'd have, I think 5 to 7 guys that would come out with us, and they wanted nothing to do with it. They would just sit in their truck and we'd go run around and do stuff. So these guys actually wanted to fight for the most part, and they're actually, they weren't too bad.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, and I guess, like you said, after you came back from that first trip, some of the core soft component training you guys were able to go through, and I guess specifically like for Army Special Forces, that's kind of one of their specialties, is like working with host nation forces and that kind of thing,
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where during that deployment, a lot of the stuff that we had learned during that pre-deployment workup training cycle, we were now able to put into work, and it was really cool to see all that stuff come to fruition and see, hey, there's a reason that we're doing this, and there's a reason that this stuff works. So that was really, really cool. And if anything, all it does is, if done properly, increases your lethality. You're killing more bad dudes if those core soft skills are done properly. So, and then that just reinforces all of your training. So,
right. And I think one of the kind of benefits for, standing up a soft unit. I mean, even though you guys came from units where you guys had those soft skills, in terms of shooting and patrolling and everything like that. But one of the benefits I'm going to guess is that there are all these other very experienced units around you guys where you can kind of borrow from and take some of the lessons that they learned and apply it to you guys and your deployments and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. At the team level, we were definitely doing that. During that initial kind of couple years of MARSOC, it was, the big excuse was, oh, it's a new unit, it's a new organization, it's growing pains. The problem that we would run into at the team level, and this isn't a bad thing, or it's not a slight against anybody, it was kind of a bad thing, to be honest, was at the team level, we were light years ahead of the entire headquarters component and everybody above us. It was one of those things, It was one of those things where, like, at the team level, like, oh, hey, there's a reason that, the SEALs do this. There's a reason the Green Berets are doing this. There's a reason other units are doing certain things. Let's pick all the good things that they're doing, and then let's make it work for us in our own way and go forward. The problem we would have is with the higher ups and the component at the time, they were just still stuck very much in that conventional Marine Corps mindset. And it was pretty painful for a lot of years. And then now you've got a guy that was a team commander 10 years ago is now a colonel, and he's now in charge of, so that's awesome. And that is part of the whole growing pains. But where our frustration really came in is, you could look at the Green Berets like, hey man, here's a great blueprint. This is what works. Let's take that. They've already done all the hard work, but we were kind of reinventing the wheel there for a little bit, and it was brutal, man.
Right. And I can imagine that that's somewhat difficult, because, you have all these kind of old school Marines who grew up in the Marine Corps and, spent their entire careers doing things a certain way. And then, that soft way of doing things is a bit different. And I didn't really think about it until you mentioned it, but that makes a lot of sense. And I can imagine that there was some frustration on that level. It's just interesting to see the kind of level of growth. I know I remember reading an article maybe last year, and the article was talking about, or maybe it was like a year and a half ago, something like that, how officers from MARSOC were, leading the JSOC component over in the Middle East for a little bit. I don't remember if it was in Iraq or what, but I remember people were kind of sharing it on social media, Marines or whatever, and it was kind of looked at as just kind of a sign that shows the growth that the command has undergone in that short period of time.
Oh, dude, absolutely. And if it wasn't for Afghanistan, if it wasn't for the GWAT, there would be no MARSOC. And Afghanistan definitely put us out into the forefront. I think the Marine Corps and MARSOC proved, like, hey, man, we are a formidable unit. Put us in and you will get results. And that's a guarantee, man. So, and going back to the Marine Corps thing, the harder part, too, when we stood up, and even around that 2009, 2010 timeframe, for the longest time, and there's no elite within the elite. And that was one of the main reasons, that the Marine Corps never went to US SOCOM to begin with. It was, well, the Marine Corps is already elite. We don't need to belong to another subcomponent. And I always kind of joke, you know, there was a guy next to me at boot camp that peed his pants every single night. And I'm like, man, if that dude's a Marine and that dude's elite, then all right, whatever you guys say, man. And that's not to take anything away from the Marine Corps. I think the Marine Corps as a whole does a tremendous job, especially the infantrymen. The Marine Corps rifleman has the hardest job. Anybody in that 03 community has the hardest job, hands down, in the Marine Corps. So hats off to the infantrymen in the Marine Corps.
Right, right. Okay, so Pete, after your second deployment, so how many deployments do you have total?
So I did 4. So 1 to Iraq and then 3 to the Helmand.
Okay. So, and after each rotation, were things still changing or did you guys kind of settle into your pace?
I think a lot of it became more routine, but I mean, to remain relevant and to remain a really lethal force, things are constantly evolving. So, I mean, you're constantly in touch with the teams that are overseas and you're implementing that most up-to-date, you know, tactic or procedure into your training real time, you know, whereas, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was, hey, this is the way we train and this is why, where now it constantly evolves. So you still have your same core skill sets, your same core tasks. Right. But in terms of like employment or some of the TTPs, you know, that stuff evolves rapidly.
Right. Absolutely. And so throughout your entire time as a Marine Raider, was your specialty still as a radio operator?
No. So my first trip, I was a driver and the radio operator. And then after that, I was an assistant element leader and then an element leader. So at that point, you know, it's MARSOC. It's the whole jack of all trades, master of none. So you're anything, you know, from an assaulter to doing intel to being a sniper to being a JTAC and everything in between. So yeah, I wasn't a fan of being a radio operator. I just did not like it. Not a fun job. Not a fun job.
Right, and I'm also gonna imagine that. As a radio operator, you guys are carrying a lot of shit.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's carrying a lot of stuff and right. Don't get me wrong. It was one of those things where, you know, as your primary responsibility for being a radio operator, it's hugely important. You're the lifelink to that team. You're the lifelink right. For a medevac, for CAS, whatever it is. It's just, you know, there are other specialties that I wanted to get into that interested me more than, you know, carrying radios. And dude, in this day and age, every soft guy is probably carrying two radios. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right,
so
either way.
So it's super important to be able to understand it, but it just came down to more of like the backside support of being a radio operator that I just wasn't hugely keen on.
Right. Okay. So Pete, you have a bit of like an interesting deployment story. as a MARSOC Marine, can you tell that story? I mean, you have a bunch of different stories, but this one specific, that was kind of interesting. We talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was my 2012 deployment. So we had the 7th Commandos, 7th Kandak for the Helmand. Super kinetic mission. Really fun deployment. We got there October 1st of 11, and we left, June 6th, 2012. So during that time, we were flying out with the 160th. My team did 31 helo inserts. I was a part of 30 of them, and it was a blast, man. Every time we were going out, we were fighting our brains out. It was a really good time. So the story that you're referring to, we were actually, it was a company clearing operation. So we had a handful of MSOTs, Marine Special Operations teams, and then we had an Army Special Forces team. I think it was with 3rd Kandak from Western Afghanistan. So we had a lot of boots on the ground. So during this time, we had cleared the ops box for this particular push. It was probably about 2 kilometers east to west and maybe 7-8 K north to south. So during this time, I think my element alone found 100 pressure plates in the ground. So as you can imagine, I mean, and that was the other really gnarly thing, being in Afghanistan from 07 up to 2012. I mean, it went from legacy anti-tank mines to very like a high metal signature. Improvised explosive to a low or no metal signature pressure plate, which that just makes everything all the more interesting. So for this particular mission, we'd inserted did our normal business that first night, and then the first full day cycle we were there, we fought all day, not a big deal. And then that second night, I needed to move about 2 kilometers. So we walked pretty far, got into our compound. And again, you're navigating at night in a extremely highly IED'd area. So it's pretty nerve-wracking. I walked point man. I was the number one dude for every mission on deployment except for my first one. And then that gets into the whole tactics and everything on it. So we walked pretty far that second night, got to a compound of interest, at which time we had one of our Afghans step on a pressure plate. I was severely concussed. A good buddy of mine was also severely concussed as a result of that. We were actually standing on the rooftop directly looking over the doorway when he activated that pressure plate. So that hurt for a little bit. Had a good headache for a couple days. So that's the second night of a 9-day mission. And that's the other part of like being a SOF, being a member of SOF, is just because you have a bad day doesn't mean that the mission's over. Doesn't mean that you can tap out and leave. You know, you're there until you can't fight anymore. And that's the bottom line.
Right.
So, so the one dude died. We had another guy get wounded. We medevac them. And then we walked another kilometer through, again, extremely highly saturated IED territory, get to a compound, probably go to sleep for about 2 hours. And I wake up to radio chatter coming in from the Taliban. Hey, we're moving on their compound. We're going to go ahead and attack them. So at that point, I grab myself, 3 other US, and probably a force of about 15 Afghan commandos. We got about 150 meters out of the compound and we're ambushed. And then from that point, we fought all day long. It was a really good fight. We ended up moving about another 2 kilometers straight line distance. So you're just running back and forth. Imagine if you just threw like a piece of spaghetti on a map, just bloop, and then that's kind of like what our route looked like that day. Got to a compound and I'm looking at my GPS and I'm like, oh shit, man, we are really overextended. You know, now the enemy can have freedom of movement between these two elements. This is not good. We're just going to hold up here until nightfall. We'll keep this territory and I'll bring the rest of my guys up at nightfall. So I breach a wall. We get everybody in the compound. We clear the compound. And we had a British Apache overhead. And he's just kind of reporting, just giving us atmospherics. We'd probably been in this compound for about 15, 20 minutes. Most of us had taken our gear off. We're filling up water. We're reconsolidating ammunition. I had, I think, 2 guys up on the roof, 2 of the Afghan machine gunners up on the roof in the prone. And they're just, you know, conducting surveillance. They're looking for dudes. And my Air Force CCT calls me over and he says, hey, Pete, this Apache's saying there's a dude like 100 meters out of your compound. I'm like, no fucking way, man. I just blew this wall down. We've been fighting all day. All right, cool. They're probably probing. So I put on my Peltors. I have my carbine. And then I walk over to the door. And I'm looking. And I'm like, holy shit, there's a fucking dude. All right, no big deal. I'm like, I'm going to let him get a little bit closer. So he's walking north to south. He's in open farm fields. And he's walking towards us. My buddy comes up. And we're looking at it. We're looking at this guy. And I'm like, hey, once he gets in this alleyway, we'll let him get like 10 meters into the alleyway. We'll open the door and then we'll dump him. The reason I wanted to let him get into the alleyway is he could only run north. He couldn't kind of zigzag or get out of my field of view. And it would just make it a little bit easier for us to dump this dude. So we're hanging out. We're getting ready to engage this guy. And my interpreter comes walking up. And the guy sees him through the crack in the door and sees him, turns around, takes off running. So I go chasing out after this dude. So I have Peltors and a carbine with a full magazine, and that's it. Same loadout, Peltors and a carbine with a full magazine. We get out there, we're chasing the guy. Now we've PID'd his AK-47. We see him. We start shooting at him. He falls in a field probably about 50 feet away from us. So can I get into an L shape? So I'm running directly towards this dude. He's now moving north up the same ditch that this guy used, chasing after this guy. Now, meanwhile, this British Apache is reporting all of this it's a company clearing ops. There's a lot of ears listening to this. So in my best British accent, it's, you know, Roy, I see one male. He appears to have a gun. He appears to have a weapon. Oh, wait, there's 3 men. Oh, they're shooting at him. One has a very large X on his back. So the X is my suspenders on my dumb ass. So, and all of this, you know, this is all unbeknownst to us. So this guy's, you know, I'm getting ready to engage and my CCT is calling him off. Hey, wave off, friendlies. So now we're on the ground. The the crop at this time was probably about thigh high. So I actually lose visual on this dude. So I'm walking up, and I regain visual probably about 15 feet away. And as soon as I see him, he sees me, and he's on his back and just full auto with his AK, brrr, just right at me. And I remember looking through my L-can, walking forward and just shooting him in the chest. And I'm like, oh, fuck, this is really going to hurt. So I just keep walking forward, just keep shooting this dude in the chest. My buddy Eric is shooting him in the chest. And then I hear Eric yell, out of ammo. So then I button hooked around, and the guy's still going. The bad dude's still going. So I just button hooked around and shot him in the face, probably 6 or 7 times, which again immediately just incapacitates him. So I take a knee, and I look at him, and I'm like, hey man, let's get a picture of this guy with his loadout, because we're gonna get hit. So there's a picture somewhere floating around, you know, on the hard drives we had overseas that I'm sure have all been destroyed by now, of me taking a knee down to this just like hunk of meat at this point. And then the very next picture is us pinned down in a ditch. So we're now under really accurate medium machine gun fire from the north, from probably about 200 meters away. And I remember looking at it and just being like, oh, this sucks. All right, well, we'll be fine. So reach over on top of the dead dude, or I crawl over to the dead dude. I grab his AK. I reach into his chest rig, grab a fresh source of ammo, load the AK, and then I start putting rounds into the darker spots where I think the machine gun fire is coming from. All of a sudden, this tree line, like 30 meters north of us, just erupts. And we're laying there, we're like, holy shit, what the hell is that? And then it stops, and we're like, man, like, we didn't know what it was at the time. So I get back up, start taking some more shots. At this time, another really good buddy of mine jumps off of the roof. He's watching all this. He's got a scar heavy. He comes running up to assist us. So he's putting rounds on where we think this machine gun fire is coming from. And the whole time, this British Apache is just wanting to just shoot us. You know, I'm not sure what to do. They're engaging one another. I'm not sure what to do. Luckily, so what ended up, we ended up finding out later on, obviously, that the trees erupting was the Apache doing gun runs. So it clicked after the second one. We're laying in the prone, and as I'm like pancaked to the earth, I look up and I'm like, oh, it's the helicopter. Okay, cool. On the next one, we're going to bound back. So on the third gun run from the Apache, we ended up bounding back, get back to the compound. And I'm just covered in this dude's like blood and gore. And I'll never, my commandos, I'll never forget it, were just looking at me like, holy shit, Commander Pete, holy shit. You know, I'm smiling ear to ear. You've got adrenaline just maxed out. You know what I mean? You're like, holy shit, that worked. I lived. That was wild.
Right.
So yeah, it was a pretty interesting story. We ended up finding, the next afternoon, moving a little further north, we found the machine gun bunker. So it was about a 2-foot-thick mud wall. And then behind that was another probably 6 to 8 inches of concrete. There's a concrete-reinforced bunker inside of this compound. And that's where we were taking the medium machine gun fire from the day prior when we were out in the open. So
they were pretty squared away with that setup, right?
Absolutely, man. And that goes back to what you and I were talking about earlier in the conversation. Not all these guys are a bunch of cave dwelling, you know, Neanderthals. Some of these guys know what's up. So it was a good time for sure.
And was that your last rotation?
Yeah, that was. So I came back summer 2012, back to 1st Raider Battalion. And then at that point, I volunteered to go be an instructor. You know, so I have a young family. I wanted to spend some time with them, so I ended up going out to the schoolhouse from 2013 until 2015, and then I got out of the Marine Corps.
Okay, so what was the total time that you were in the Marine Corps?
12 years.
Okay, awesome. Awesome. And then, so now it's known that you guys are Marine Raiders. When did that change take place?
Probably, I think, 2 years ago at this point, but it was one of those things where when we stood up back in 2006, a handful of the guys from that first West Coast platoon actually went and sat down with living Raiders from World War II and said, hey guys, this is who we are. This is what's going on. We would be honored to carry on the name Marine Raider. And of course, these guys, they were all for it. They're like, they were flattered. So at that point,
yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a very humbling experience, you know, to get the blessing from those guys. So at that point on, every guy in that first West Coast platoon wore a Raider patch, wore a Marine Raider patch. And then, so we had been doing it since we stood up in 2006. Okay. The Marine Corps didn't officially recognize it until just a couple of years ago. And again, it's hugely proud. And there's only a few of those guys still alive from World War II.
Right.
And they're the proudest guys on planet Earth that were able to carry on the tradition and continue to do great things just as those guys did.
Right. And they fought mostly in the Pacific or they were kind of everywhere?
Generally in the Pacific, and that's where one of the first questions I often get are, what are the five stars? And that's the Southern Cross constellation that's very near and dear to the 1st Marine Division, and then as well as the Raider units in the South Pacific in World War II.
Yeah, I mean, that was some really heavy fighting.
I couldn't even imagine, man. I mean, you think about it now, you know, people are having a hard time now going overseas for 6 months, and then they come home. You know, and even when you're overseas, you know, you go to some of these bigger camps and there's a TGI Fridays and Subway, and these dudes are living in the jungle for years. You know what I mean?
Like, so just hardcore shit, like, and you know, war, you know, battles where, you know, 10,000 dudes are dying, and it's just like a war of attrition, you know, and all around. And I mean, but there, you know, there are different type of, you know, challenges that each generation of warfighters faces for their, you know, particular war, you know?
Absolutely.
Okay, so now you've got out of the Marine Corps. You've been out for what, 2 years now?
Yeah, I got out July of 2015. Yep.
Okay, so you know obviously the transition is a kind of a very important process for guys getting out, especially warfighters. And how have you found that so far?
I found it pretty good. You know, initially, like the first couple months, like you're kind of waiting to go back to your work. Cause again, I mean, I only did it for 12 years. So I can't even imagine guys that are doing it for 20, 25 years, what that must feel like to not go back and do that.
Right.
Cause it's one of those things. If you're a successful, soft guy, you know, it's not a job. It's your entire life. It's your whole life being, you eat, sleep, shit, breathe your job. You know what I mean? And that's where that is one thing that I definitely miss. It's the caliber of guy that you're working with. You know, for example, you know, you would get up, you would go lift weights for an hour, and then you would train, you know, 12, 15, 18 hour days. And the guys were still going home and they're getting on their laptops and they're studying, or you'd go over to your buddy's house on the weekend and they'd be in full gear, you know, practicing, putting a nerve breeches on the doors of their house just to be that much faster and that much more proficient. So, and that's the caliber of guy that you're working with day in and day out in a soft organization, and it's awesome. So it's a little bit of an adjustment period going from somebody where it's like, and it's good. You know what I mean? It was more of an adjustment period for my own brain of like, you know, you're not on the clock 24 hours a day, you know? So it's, you know, that 9-to-5 job, and that took a little bit of time to get into, but I was fortunate. I work for Ops Corps now. You know, and that's the same helmet that I wore when I was in. So being in the defense industry is really nice, and it's definitely helpful. And then now in my current role, I mean, I still go down to Camp Pendleton to First Raider, and I see, you know, all my old buddies, and it's, hey man, how can I help you guys? What do you need? So it's I'm in a very good place, and I'm super lucky to have to work where I work and be able to still go down and kind of touch the magic, as they say, you know?
Right, and kind of stay involved and help out in your own way.
100%, man. Yeah, it's very gratifying.
Okay, and you're also you're doing some stuff for television, right?
Yeah, so that's actually kind of funny. Probably back in March now, I was approached from a couple buddies. Hey, man, we did this thing with this producer and their production crew, Dream Quest Production. They're looking for a guy. They want to do a tactical show to go on the Sportsman Channel. They're like, we can't do it. We're getting ready to go on deployment. You're out. We thought you'd be a good candidate. You should just put your name in, man. So I submitted a resume and a bio, a handful of pictures. And just like any other job, you know, you interview. So there's the whole screening and selection process. And then I actually interviewed and sat down with the producer, Alan Smith, who's a super good dude, really good human being. We sat down, had dinner, had some drinks, and kind of talked about my background and then where I thought I could take the show. And then throughout that process, probably another 5-6 weeks went by, and then it was, hey, you're in the top 10, top 5, top 3, top 2. And then, you know, I'm at my day job at Ops Corps and got a phone call. Hey, man, you want to host a TV show? Because you're the guy. Awesome. So that was pretty, yeah. So that was really funny. So, and I'm flattered again to have that opportunity.
Okay. And how many episodes is it? Like, is it a certain, you know, are you guys doing like 6 episodes, 12 episodes? How's that working?
Yeah. So we're going to do 13 episodes, 12 of which will have, you know, some really fun, hard hitting, running and gunning type content. And then we'll do one episode, probably the 9th or 10th episode, where we'll do a live viewer Q&A. So again, we'll let everybody know ahead of time on our social media, on our website, where you can actually go on and just ask whatever you want to know about the show, about anything, you know, weapons or techniques related, or about, you know, my silly ass.
Okay, awesome, man. So so if people are interested in like kind of keeping up with the show and anything else regarding that, where can they go to do that?
Yeah. So right now the best place would be my Instagram. It's going to be PeterPerry8. Get on there. You guys can DM me, ask anything you guys want. You know, I probably get 5 to 10 emails a day asking, you know, how to become a Marine Raider, how to become a Marine, different questions on, you know, gear or guns. And I love it, man. I love talking to everybody. It's really cool for me. So that would be one way. And then as we get closer to the show, we'll launch a website and then we'll launch all the social media for the show itself.
Awesome. Okay. So maybe, when you guys get a little closer to the launch date, we can get you back on and maybe, and you know, a lot of, people hit me up, you know, asking questions, you know, about, you know, Marines or, you know, sniper, you know, a bunch of different things. Maybe we could have you back on and you can answer some of those questions.
In a heartbeat, man. I would love to. And then if I don't know it, I'll put you guys in contact with a subject matter expert on that. So yeah, I would love to come on again, dude. Definitely.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, it was great having you on, brother. You know, I appreciate you sharing your story and, you know, your experiences. And I know the audience definitely will, and especially the younger generation of guys who are, you know, looking to join special operations or join the Marine Corps and, you know, get into the infantry and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think kind of one last thing just going into the TV show is going to be, you know, there's a lot of, everyone has a platform now just with social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Right. And there's a lot of things out there that when done, although they look cool and sexy on social media, will definitely get your ass shot off in a real gunfight. And I'm not talking like full frontal fight in the Taliban. I'm talking like a one-on-one gunfight with an adversary. So, you know, definitely with the TV show, it'll be using the same tactics, techniques, and procedures that I was taught and I learned and that I taught, you know, while teaching CQB and marksmanship and weapons, that I want to teach, you know, the everyday gun owner just to make, you know, a little bit more effective and a little bit safer.
Right, because there are people who can shoot, you know, civilians, but I think the lines get a little blurred with what, you know, what's reality or what's effective in a gunfight and kind of, you know, and I think social media lends to some of that, you know, like with the size of the following and that kind of thing. And I guess, you know, that's one of the kind of the negatives of social media. It could kind of amplify things that aren't correct or that shouldn't be amplified, you know?
Oh, dude, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, for everybody listening, if there's guys that are sports shooters or they're, you know, they're shooting Ipsic, whatever the guys are shooting, you know, we take a lot from that and we actually implement that into combat marksmanship. What I'm talking about, you know, you have 120,000 followers, doesn't make you a gunfighter, doesn't make you a subject matter expert. So that's kind of the one, you know, one facet of the show is, hey, these are real TTPs that I've used in easily over 100 gunfights that actually work. So.
Right. Right. Awesome, man. Awesome. All right, Peter, it was great having you on, brother.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. Thank you for having me on again. Go PeterPerry8 on Instagram. You guys can shoot me a DM and we can talk all day long. So thank you, John, for having me. And thank you everybody for tuning in and listening. I definitely appreciate it.
It was great having Pete on, to have a guy with his experience as a Marine Raider and to have him share his experiences and kind of go through that entire process of how MARSOC, the Marine Special Operations Command, was stood up and the journey. And they're a relatively new unit. So, you know, coming up during the middle of a war, things happened fast and much faster than they would had they been stood up during peacetime. So it was just cool to hear that story and hear some of that history, and then some of the stories that Pete shared during his of his operational service overseas. So with that, we'll wrap up this week's podcast. Check out my website at globalrecon.net. Check me out on Facebook at FB Recon. Check me out on Instagram at IG Recon. Check out the other account that I have. It's Black Ops Matter. Check out Chantel Taylor at @mission_critical. Her other page on Instagram is Alternative RV. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can do iTunes for Apple products and SoundCloud for Android. Just search Global Recon Podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud. You know, download the episode, share them with your friends and family. That way we can continue to remain at the top of the iTunes government and national categories and continue to provide you guys with high quality content. So we'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace.